When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does an 18-year veteran of the tech industry and a 20-year veteran of the military have in common? More than you might think. Welcome, everyone, to the Second Act podcast, leveling up your life's journey. Welcome back, John.
What up, Michael? How you doing, man?
Good, 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 good. Another amazing spring day and exciting guest episode today. Things are going well. How about you?
Man, I say this a lot, but I'm excited for today's episode. One, because this dude is a stud, and he's a friend of mine. And I've met him in person, hung out with him in person. And so I know the quality of content that we're going to get. But that being said, I think every episode's pretty miraculous. After it comes out, I listen to it again, and I think, man, it's amazing the people that are out there doing the thing and making a change, you know, for the community around them, but also just jumping on with us and making a change for our community. So I feel blessed to be on this journey with you, Michael, and, you know, to be able to interview people like our guest today, Marcus.
Yeah. And each story is so unique. I mean, there's definitely some commonalities among the journey and the ups and downs that we see in terms of like personal attributes, like grit and perseverance and faith and things like that. But then the stories are so different. And that's what I think makes it kind of interesting. And this one is not going to be any different. So let us welcome everybody back. Welcome back, everyone, to the Second Act podcast with Michael and John. John, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Man, I'd love to. In this week's episode, we're joined by Marcus Long. And as I said, a guy that I've been able to know for about the last year, but he's the founder of A Long Legacy Capital, a real estate investment firm with holdings that span single family properties, multifamily housing, cattle farming, and private lending. Marcus, he is a busy man. He's a founding member of The War Room, The Kinetic Man, and Seven Figure Multifamily Masterminds. So a stud in commercial real estate and real estate in general. Prior to his entrepreneurial ventures, Marcus spent 21 years as a cryptologic warfare officer in the Navy.
That sounds cool.
With his range of experience spanning from a time aboard a submarine to advising admirals on Navy war strategy to satellite intelligence collection and analysis at the Aerospace Data Facility. It's going to make me feel like a dummy, I bet. Marcus's life started in Missouri as one of five children, but he now calls Kansas home with his wife and two kids. Outside of work, Marcus enjoys traveling, educating, and serving other investors and his community. So, man, that is a lot. Marcus is a busy man. I rarely catch him on the phone because he's always going and coming, but man, we got him roped into an hour-long episode here, so welcome to the show, Marcus.
Awesome. Thanks, John. I appreciate the incredible intro and make me sound a lot smarter than I really am. But no, it's awesome. I appreciate you all having me and sharing your space with me today with your audience.
Yeah. Man, well, absolutely. I'm stoked. And you are smart. You are an incredibly intelligent person. I recognize that every time that I get to sit down and talk to you in person, but
I think John, one of the smartest things that I do is surround myself with a lot of other smart people that make me look smart sometimes. So
Well, well either said. Way, well you said. Do a great job. So,
and Candace, I'm probably going to ruffle some feathers here, but in my opinion, has some of the best, if not the best, barbecue in the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll have a hard time on this one because, you know, I presently reside technically in the state of Kansas. I grew up in Missouri. I've always called Missouri home in reality. Yeah. And it probably will ruffle some feathers because most people will say, hey, you know, Kansas City, most things, you know, the Chiefs, the Royals, most of the barbecue, whatever, really reside on the Missouri side. It just happens to have Kansas name. So when people ask where I live, you know, I'm always like, well, technically, you know, like 5 minutes across the border, but it was one of those like mental hurdles you have to get over that I'm in a Kansas zip code after, you know, living in Missouri, growing up in Missouri and stuff. So
nice. Nice.
And for those that don't know Top Gun, incredibly well, like I do, the place where they play Great Balls of Fire is actually in San Diego and the place is called Kansas City Barbecue.
There you go. I've been there a couple times for someone I lived out there.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So just proof that Kansas City's got some pretty good barbecue or they wouldn't be bringing it halfway across the nation to San Diego. So
that's right.
All right. Should we jump into it? Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get into it with Marcus. And let's start, Marcus. We always like to kick it off with getting into just the background of some of our guests, of all of our guests. So with you, you're born in rural Missouri. One of five children. Let's start there. Tell us about life growing up in a relatively big family and some of the maybe important lessons from your childhood that helped you, help shape who you are today.
Yeah, man, there's a lot there. You could probably do a whole episode on childhood and how it shapes my life today. But as you said, you know, I grew up in rural Missouri, a town of a couple thousand people. In fact, I lived on a farm outside of the town, so pretty rural. I was a middle child. I had two older brothers, two younger sisters. We're each, between 2 and 3 years apart from each other, so about 10 years that spanned my oldest brother and my youngest sister. And, I would say that we are generally a pretty close family. My parents have been married for, I think, 49 years at the moment and stuff, and so a generally close family, but that doesn't come without, a lot of challenges, throughout the years and stuff as well. We came from I was a family of pretty humble beginnings. I can remember as a young child, going to collect aluminum cans and selling them to get money for my oldest brother's school supplies
when
he started school.
Sure.
And as I was probably second grade time frame, my dad had was in a farming accident where he eventually was an amputee and stuff. But throughout that process, actually had a blood clot in his lungs, and we were very close to losing him. So both the experience almost losing, him at that point in time, as well as losing his leg and stuff certainly impacted our lives, our childhood and our lives and the direction thereon. And so those are just kind of a couple, of the challenges at a young age. And then my dad was always, my mom was a teacher. My dad was a farmer mostly and stuff. And he worked for other people a lot of times up until about when I was 13, we bought our own farm, and my dad had gone to school for horse training and management. That was his degree out in Colorado. He kind of managed a ranch and stuff out there for a while. And so we actually started our own horse training business. So I always grew up around horses and stuff. But from that point in time, one of my brother and I were actually on the LLC. When the business was created as a 13-year-old, I was a member of that LLC, right? So some of my business stuff kind of started fairly early. But, my dad had high expectations. We were a member of that business. So we were going to contribute and stuff. So just like growing up on a farm, I spent a lot of time with him. So everything from the example of hard work to, how he treated our customers and the integrity within the business. There's a lot of probably lessons there. You know, I spent, you know, weekends, evenings, summers, you know, as a teenager, a lot more time, you know, on the farm and working and with him than, you know, running around town doing teenage boy type of stuff. So, yeah, you can dig in, anywhere there, but there was a lot of lessons. My dad was a convert, into the Catholic faith. He's now a deacon in the Catholic Church. My mom taught in the Catholic Church, taught in the Catholic school for all the years that I went through school and stuff. So certainly, you know, faith was a big part of our family, and certainly contributed in a lot of ways in many of the challenges that we went through as a family, over the years and stuff as well. So that's a little bit of the, you know, kind of going back into my childhood, and happy to dive in if there's anywhere specific you want to kind of hit on.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, you know, in the time that I've spent with you, I didn't know some of that detail to your childhood, but one thing that I recognize, and I know that a lot of the other men who've been around you recognize, is that work ethic, is that integrity, and that desire to provide not only for your family, but help those around you. And you kind of always have an open arm, you know, I look at it as an open arm policy. We're just kind of trying to grab as many people around you and say, come with me and let's make everything better together. And now that I've heard, you know, some more of the detail to the way that you were raised, it's evident. I mean, people that grow up in and around farms are some of the most generous, humble, hardworking people that I've ever met. And it just makes it even more apparent to why you're such a good person and such a joy to be around. So it really helps kind of solidify what I think of you. So that's really cool.
I certainly appreciate that. I think, you know, as much as I appreciate the kind words and stuff, I think that it's a testament to my family, to my parents, you know, and stuff, and the type of the people in the community and stuff that I grew up in, because you're right, you know, it's like we built that business and stuff. We didn't really do a lot of like marketing and advertising and stuff. Like my dad's marketing and advertising was him as a man and a human and how he treated people, and his fairness and the word of mouth that spread with that. And as you said, like people that grew up in the farming community, and you know, if one farmer's down, others come to the aid and help them and get their harvest out or whatever. And I think, you know, the testament that shows to like my parents of who I am today is speaks a lot about them.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, before we kicked off the show, we were talking about one of our past guests who also spent some time in a rural part of his state on a farm. And there seems to be some consistency with a childhood like that going on to do some pretty cool and interesting things later on in life. So maybe there's something to spending some part of your childhood on a farm. I'm going to have to reconsider my strategy here.
You know, we joke around. My brother, one of my older brothers in the military as well. And we always kind of joke that, man, as many things we can complain about the country that we live in and the state of it today and stuff like that, like there's still some amazing opportunities, you know, humble farm boy from Missouri, and some of the things that we've gone on to have the opportunity to do, you know, we have some pretty incredible opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that said, you grew up on a farm, then after high school, you decide to enlist in the Navy. So how did that sort of transpire, and what led to the decision that eventually pivoted you into becoming a cryptologic warfare officer, one of the cooler titles I've ever come across?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, like my decision to go into the Navy and the military and stuff in general, because, you know, my grandparents, or my grandfathers, I should say, both served in the military. I had a few uncles that did. Most of them, you know, kind of for their, you know, 4 or 6 years type of thing in World War II, you know, Korean conflict, Vietnam War, stuff like that. One uncle that was in for about 30 years. And then my oldest brother joined the Navy about a year or so before I did. And it certainly wasn't like something I had intended to do forever. And in fact, it was kind of a late decision in my senior year of high school. I really enjoyed, you know, training horses and the amount of time I spent with my dad and stuff. And honestly, I kind of thought like, hey, this is what I was going to do later on, and even go to college and stuff for that as well. And I don't know if my dad would even remember these comments, but at some point in time, it wasn't like him giving me like advice or trying to tell me like what to do necessarily. It was kind of a more relaxed, nonchalant like conversation. And as I mentioned, he had gone to college for horse training and management. He had managed a 25,000 acre ranch at one point in time. And when I kind of talked about going to school for that, you know, my dad had made a comment at some point and said, you know, I wouldn't recommend doing that. He's essentially like, you've spent so much time here with me. Like, you know, my dad wasn't a vet, but he could, you know, he would doctor on the horses and stuff like that. And like, he just had so much knowledge and practice and stuff. And essentially he's like, you have learned from like on the job training, you know, 90% of what you're going to go to school to learn. And I don't, you know, he wasn't trying to like dissuade me from doing that if that's what I wanted to do. But he was essentially saying like, hey, if you're going to go to school, you know, get educated or, you know, get something that you could fall back on, right?
Yeah.
He was like, you already know this. You could not go to college and come do this. And so those comments kind of like got me to thinking like, oh, well, if I'm not going to go to college for that, what am I going to go to college for? And I think initially I kind of like, I didn't know what it was that I want, what else it was I wanted to do. And I didn't want to waste time, you know, knowing what I know now, you can go to a year or two of school and, you know, switch what your major, your degree and stuff like that fairly easily. But at the time I was like, well, I don't really want to go to college and waste time not really knowing. And, it was kind of interesting because my brother had asked me about, you know, he joined the Navy about a year before I did, and he asked me about coming into the military. I was like, absolutely not. You know, I was like, I had admittedly, I had like kind of played with the idea of like National Guard or reserves or something for some like college money. But I basically told my brother, like, I will never go active duty. And if I do, the last place I'll go is the Navy. Right. And, that didn't age well. You know, not long at all, because you know what it was 6 months later or something like that. I was like, well,
here I am.
Maybe I'll look at the military. And you know, I think because of a few, my brother and a couple other people from my hometown that were like in the Navy that had kind of come back and were talking and stuff, I kind of started looking at opportunities there. And at the time, my brother was in a nuclear program, and he was kind of like, hey, why don't you look at being a nuke? And I was like, no, like, I always did pretty well in school and stuff, but it wasn't necessarily, I didn't enjoy it that much, right? My family always jokes around how I didn't like in high school, I probably never took a book home, stuff. And so while I did well, I wasn't necessarily the best, you know, student as far as that goes. I know being in the nuclear program, you'd have to study. So I was like, nah, I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, I know I have a couple of friends that are cryptologists and stuff, you know, so he kind of introduces me to that career field. And lo and behold, I, you know, enlisted in the Navy. And at the time, my intention was like, hey, I'm going to do 4 years, you know, give me some time to figure life out, and then I'll go back to school. And in reality, instead of figuring life out, it just opened up, you know, more opportunities. And that's, you know, kind of while I was enlisted, transitioned in, had the opportunity to get selected for a commissioning program. And, you know, then they sent me back to the University of Missouri. So go Tigers. And that's kind of where the rest of my career, military career started, is 21 years later.
In cryptology, that's code breaking or something? Or like, what are the dimensions of cryptology that you can share?
Yeah. I mean, so broadly, you know, I mean, going back to kind of World War II is kind of where the history of like naval cryptology started, and, you know, the U.S. kind of intercepting some communications from the Japanese about like the location of where ships were going to be or attacks or things like that. Right. And so there's some different career fields. You know, both like initially when I enlisted, even though I was a cryptologist, I was actually setting up our US or Blue Force communications. So, secure networks and things from our own side. And when I had some free time, I would help some of the other fields and stuff as well. But, you know, over time, obviously it being historically like code breaking, signals intelligence, things of that nature, obviously things have gone from, you know, Morse code style stuff to a little bit higher technologies nowadays. Yeah, I mean, there's some cyber components and stuff to the career field and stuff like that as well now.
Very cool.
So you spend 4 years enlisted, go back to University of Missouri. What did you study while you were there? And then what was there a commitment already on the backside to go back and go back to the Navy as an officer?
Yeah, that's correct. So the program that I did, when I got selected, they were paying essentially, I was still on salary, you know, still active duty. They were paying for the education. And I had it was either a 4 or 6 year commitment.
Okay.
On the backside of the education. It's an interesting story, kind of, maybe not to others, but in my own mind, I initially was going to put as my degree intention when I put in the application, I was going to put in like education, right? There was a lot of educators in my own family. And this kind of, you know, 20 years later kind of comes back into play in ways as well. But like, I was going to put in education as my degree intention. And my commanding officer at the time said, hey, you know, you ultimately, you're not held to what you put in for this particular program. For the application process, you're a lot better off putting in like a STEM degree or something, you know, for getting selected. And so I ended up changing that to computer science. And he said, you know, once you get to college and stuff, if you decide you want to change, you do whatever you want to do. But I put in computer science and I got selected, and I went in the first year. I did computer science at school. And a lot of what I had been doing previously was more on the like networking side and things like that, not quite as much programming. And so I don't know, I think there was like a Friday night, I was on campus at midnight doing some programming, and I was like, you know, most of these people that are doing it have been doing it in high school, and you know, they taught themselves, and here I am, you know, a little, you know, a few years older than some of them. And I was like, I don't think this is what I, you know, I'm not necessarily programming day in and day out. And so I didn't really enjoy it that much. And so at that point in time, after about a year, I transitioned over to finance.
Okay.
We went to the business school for the last 2 years. That transition period, you know, I kind of probably did it right about the right time, because that one semester that I transitioned, I was taking about 18 hours. I was taking day classes at Mizzou, and then I would go across town to another small college and take some night classes there. And so
my sister
lived with me that year, and she probably regretted the decision because I was probably a bit cantankerous. But
well, coming from the guy who said he's not, he just surrounds himself with smart people. So
yeah.
So just myth busted right there. All right, Marcus. So you leave Mizzou with finance major, go back to the Navy, and your career from that point on ranges from submarines to satellites. What are some of the standout moments? And if you can sum up a 21-year career in a few minutes, that you really look back on to propel you forward to where you are now.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough, because I did, you know, a wide range, and, you know, I kind of joke sometimes, not really joke, this is true, but like when I look at the broad range of things that I had the opportunity to do, one of the things that highlights that is I actually took an oath on a surface ship, on a submarine, flying in a helicopter, and inside a dome that covers one of our satellite antennas in Colorado.
That's very
right?
Cool.
So when you talk about subsurface, surface, air, and into space. And that's kind of where I, you know, got my promotions and took the oath of office in those different places. And so, you know, when I left Mizzou, I went out to a station in Hawaii, as you mentioned, riding submarines. And the particular, you know, job that I was doing weren't necessarily assigned to a specific submarine. We kind of flew around the world and met up with different submarines and executed the various missions. And it was pretty demanding. Yep. Professionally rewarding, right? I mean, we were kind of on short term, you know, wasn't unusual for people that were doing what I was doing to get a call and say, hey, you have a flight in 48 to 96 hours to go meet a submarine somewhere in the world, and you were going to be gone for 2, 3, 4 months, right?
Yeah.
And I also got married during that tour, right? So my wife we went to college together. She was also in the military, and she was on a ship. And here I was doing this submission that had kind of short notice, calling and stuff. But it was as demanding as it was extremely rewarding, you know, as a mid 20 some year old to have expertise in a certain field or area in which these commanding officers of, you know, high value U.S. assets would ask for your advice on where to position, you know, this asset and stuff.
Yeah.
And like when you built the level of trust with him and with his team, it was often executed. You know, they often took your advice. And so to be mid-20s, to have that level of trust from a commanding officer that had been doing this job for 10, 15, 20 years, you know, was rewarding. So that was a pretty, you know, awesome experience there. And, you know, when I left there, I went on to a surface ship and stuff for a few years. And then, and my wife and I were both on surface ships again. So in the first probably, I don't know, probably the first year we were engaged and 3 years of marriage, I used to know the day count, but I think we actually were physically together probably somewhere between 8 to 12 months, you know, in that 3 to 4 year period, just as a back-to-back deployments and deployment workups and things. So that was a challenging time, you know? And of course, you know, like you mentioned, being on the Admiral staff. And then of course at the aerospace data facility was a, really unique opportunity where I led, you know, about 60 people, joint military, joint multi-agency, people on a pretty high profile mission. You know, I'll go into too many details on the specifics there, but I had the opportunity, like, you know, briefing like flag officers and even congressmen, and stuff like that on a fairly regular basis. And so, I think that, you know, sometimes in my story of like when you transition, and stuff too, you can kind of come back to later. It's like, you know, you get really, the mission was pretty incredible, but there's a lot of frustrations and stuff with bureaucracy, and things as well. And so, but anyway, that, you know, we can kind of come back on that, but it was, you know, I just really think about like the opportunities I had coming from the farm, as we mentioned early, and through my mid 20s into my 30s and stuff, the level of responsibility that you are given, and the trust, you know, sometimes depending on who is in your chain of command and things like that, to be able to go and to execute a mission and stuff is pretty incredible. So that gives you, I mean, a little bit of a glimpse in a few things.
Yeah, I mean, you've had that trustworthiness since early childhood, being an owner operator of the farm with your dad, and then, you know, early 20s telling high level officers, you know, where, how to command and control whatever it is they need to do to protect the nation. And I mean, you had me at a submarine meetup when you don't hear too many people say that they had a submarine meetup with 48 hour notice. You're probably the first and last person in my lifetime who will share those words with me directly, but it's a pretty cool experience. And then over the 21 years, really amazing things it sounds like you've done while you served in the Navy.
You know, as I'm listening to your story, and for those that are just listening and not watching, I've got a huge smile on my face the whole time you're talking, because only in the military will you hear somebody who comes from a farm, has the responsibility that you have thrusted upon them to brief the people that you brief and have the buy-in from the leadership that you have, but also get, you know, 24 to 48 hour notice before they've got to, you know, up in their lives and go halfway across the world for something that they maybe have only minimally trained for, or, you know, have in their mind that they may be doing. And I just think of it. I think of my own experiences and some of the experiences of people that we've had on the show. Just what an opportunity it is to not only serve our nation, but to serve it with such standout memories that we almost look at as being commonplace. You know, And it's when we sit here and we share those experiences with Michael and and other people who haven't served, it becomes aware of just how unique those experiences are when we step back and actually process them. And
yeah, it really is incredible, John. And I think that, you know, sometimes in the moments, you know, when you're out there doing some of this stuff, it's not all glorious or it doesn't feel all that unique, right? There's some pretty crappy moments. Like on one of these sub rides, you know, the inventory of the food was off and we ended up on rations, right? And so what are we doing? Like we're through that time, we're complaining about eating, you know, like popcorn and spinach or something, you know. But after you get through those tough moments, you know, that's a lot of my closest friends throughout the U.S. and throughout the world are men and women that I went through these crappy moments at times with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when we look back, we look at these really unique missions and opportunities that we had to be in and the missions that we had to execute. And not everyone gets, we don't appreciate it always in the moment how unique it is. And, you know, less on the mission side, but one super quick story that does sometimes remind me about how unique and how few people have these stories to tell is when my wife and I, after we'd left Hawaii, we were in San Diego, we were both on ships, and she had been on a deployment and then I left on deployment and then she was going back on a deployment again. And I was actually coming down south through the Red Sea. And then our strike group was getting ready to leave the area and head back home from deployment. And her strike group was coming into the area on deployment. And so a day or so before, a couple days before, my ops officer, who was a good friend of mine, said, "Hey, would you want to fly over and see Amy, my wife?" And I'm like, you know, I was like, "Hey, don't screw with me. You know, if this isn't a real opportunity, don't be messing with me." And lo and behold, we had a Coast Guard team on board that we had to, you know, move over to her ship and stuff. And so I was actually officer of the deck one morning on the 2-7 watch. And when I went up, the commanding officer's night orders, you know, were to rendezvous with her ship. And so that was my mission through the night, was to rendezvous with her ship. And as I was coming off watch the next morning, I think she was the officer of the deck as well. We didn't realize it at the time, but I left watch, went and got a quick breakfast, and we set flight quarters, and I had the opportunity to fly over her ship.
That's cool.
Ate lunch with her for a couple hours,
you
know, middle of the ocean, on a U.S. warship, and then small boated back to my ship and came home. And that was the only couple hours I saw her that year.
Yeah.
You know, and so after the fact, sometimes we look back at these stories and we're like, who gets to say that? Like, who?
Nobody. Nobody says they have a date on a warship in the middle of this. That's amazing.
Or a couple. I saw my wife for a couple hours that year.
Oh my gosh. That's a great story, Marcus. Before we move on, I just want to come back to, so you're entrusted at an early age and in the military to do some amazing things. And I know our audience members sometimes suffer from imposter syndrome, and there's like a skill set to doing something, and then there's a mindset to doing something. So when you're given the opportunity to be entrusted to do these things, whether it's owning and operating a farm or giving strategy to a senior officer in the military, the first time that happens to you, what is going through your mind to help ease your mind and like say, hey, I'm good enough to do this and I'm going to get it done to the best of my ability for these people?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it can be pretty overwhelming. I think one thing that I did was I relied on having conversations with people that had done it before me, right? To understand the path they took, and that some of them came from similar backgrounds that I did, or, you know, and what worked and what didn't work. And, you know, I think in approaching those situations, a lot of times was to go into it with confidence, you know, that I was good enough, and confidence in the training that I had and the information that I knew, even if sometimes you get thrown into situations where you weren't trained for everything. but also honesty and transparency, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to BS a commanding officer that's been doing this stuff for 20 years, right? I'm going to be confident in the knowledge that I know and the team. You know, I had a team that was with me and to rely on them. But to understand when to ask tough questions, you know, or, and to be transparent and honest with him when I didn't know the answer, or, you know, I didn't know the situation and stuff. And so I think those are probably a couple of things that are probably applicable to a lot of situations, you know, that we approach. We're probably a little nervous about.
And back me up on this, Marcus. You know, Michael, when you ask that question, I think it's very valid, but I want to say that in the military, imposter syndrome, well, let me back up. I think imposter syndrome is a very civilian term. And it's, I wouldn't use that a lot in the military, because when you're thrust in those situations, you don't really have the opportunity to say, oh, I'm not really good enough. I think I'll bow out of this one. It's one of those deals that when you're confronted with the requirement to stand in front of some of those people, or to develop a brief, or to come up with a decision, you've seen so many people in front of you step into that same scenario and just execute. Now, maybe some execution is better than others, but when the time comes for it to be yours, you just end up doing it, and you hope that it's the best thing that you can do at the time. Is that true, Marcus? I mean, did you ever think of imposter syndrome, or was that even a phrase that you used during your time in the military?
No, I think that has been tossed around a lot more, like post-military and like my entrepreneur ventures and stuff like that afterwards. Is that feeling? Now, I would say one of my bosses and stuff, and I talked a lot about, I think probably the same scenarios happen in the military a lot, but you don't have the same feeling necessarily, right? Like we always kind of talked about, you know, when you get, you know, every couple of years or whatever, you're thrown into a new position and a new role. And at the end of that tour, you're like, just as you feel like you're getting good at something, you're like, oh, you know what? I could be a great division officer. I can be a great department head. I can be a great, you know, whatever, pilot instructor, whatever it might be. You get moved into a new role and one that you're not comfortable with or you don't know, and you're like, okay, now I got to start over. And so those same like scenarios probably happen a lot, but like I don't think you really feel like you have you were given that role, right? Yeah. You know, it's not like something, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, sometimes we're like trying to speak or you're trying to do this and you're like, I don't know if I should be doing this. And in the military, it's like you are put in that role, right? And sometimes you feel like, man, I don't feel like I had the training for this and stuff. And you've just seen other people execute it. And in reality, that other person that you are relieving, he was probably, you know, he or she often was very in a similar boat as you are right now. And it's just over the last couple of years of them doing that day in and day out that they have come as proficient as they are today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, everyone sucks at the beginning of anything they try for the first time. I mean, to put it bluntly, they are. You don't know how. I guess there's a few naturally talented people out there, but for most of us, we all suck the first time we start something. And as we're talking about this, it's a good segue, Marcus, in terms of, you know, 21 years in, and then you make the pivot to the civilian world and pursue real estate. So what was that moment and that led to the decision, and how did you find yourself in the world of real estate investing? I see a little bit of the tie with finance, but help us map that.
Yes. Kind of the line in the sand when that decision was made was about the 18-year mark, or so, 17, 18-year mark in the military. And at the time I made the decision, I was not eligible to, you know, quote unquote, retire from the military. Then, but I was getting close, and there's a couple of reasons, you know, some professional, probably more impactful, some of the personal reasons that I made that transition. And I'll kind of, you know, give you some insight into that. And like, so on the professional side, I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, some bureaucracy and stuff. And like, I was getting to the rank and stuff where you kind of saw some of that a little bit more. Right. And like, I always said, hey, I'll do this until I'm not having fun. And in fact, when I made the decision that I was going to retire, I was actually having a lot of fun in the particular mission. It was one of the most challenging yet one of the most rewarding missions that I had done in, you know, up to 18 years at that point. However, I was starting to see a lot more of the bureaucracy and, like, sometimes people more concerned about their rank, or, you know, their next rank and stuff, and not being willing to make tough decisions, you know, for the mission and stuff. And that's not necessarily unique to the military. That probably happens in a lot of different places, right? And so while that was becoming somewhat frustrating for me, it wasn't necessarily the driving factor. What was really the driving factor is during my time at the aerospace data facility, I was, you know, doing 12 plus hours a day, you know, on a shore duty, which in the military often is, you know, kind of when you're, I don't want to say downtime, but like less busy or shorter hours than if you're operational. But I was supporting some pretty operational missions, and I came home from work one day. My daughter was, you know, 3-4 at the time, and it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, much earlier than I was usually home. And she said, "Hey, Daddy, what are you doing home?" And I said, "Hey, I came home to, you know, hang out with you guys this afternoon." And she looked around and she said, "But Daddy, it's still light outside."
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, I mean, it didn't take me too long. Probably in a couple moments after that, where I was like, I knew the answer to what, you know, kind of my decision was, you know, like, as far as, am I going to continue to try to get promoted or do something different? And, I knew for my family that I was ready. Right. Yeah. And so that's kind of when I started to say, "Hey, I'm not eligible today. I have one more tour that has to be done." And, looking for like what that off ramp kind of was. And so that's what drove those factors. And John can tell you, you know, a lot of people in the military, they won't really kind of, they'll kind of hold that close to their chest, right? That decision.
Yeah.
For as long as possible. Because when you tell people that you're leaving or whatever, it, you know, might impact the way leadership or peers may treat you. It may impact your fitness reports, all of that kind of stuff. And I didn't necessarily do that, right? When I made the decision, I made it pretty clear.
Okay.
Pretty quick. And so it was an interesting period, you know, of time, both where I, you know, I felt that I was being questioned a lot, sometimes from leadership that didn't agree with my decision. Sometimes from peers that were like, why would you want to leave? You know, make the next rank and you get an extra $1,000 for retirement or whatever, you know? And it's just like this, whether it is this mentality of, hey, we need to make, everyone should want to be a flag officer. Everyone should want to make the next rank.
Yeah.
Or this like false security, you know, that W-2s sometimes give us or whatever that might be.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things, but that was kind of the time frame.
Yeah.
Of when I decided to make that transition. And on the real estate part of it, you know, I didn't talk a lot about this, but I had owned and invested in real estate since I was 22 years old.
Okay.
So when I went to the University of Missouri as a 22-year-old, I bought my first property. Then I kept it in a house hack back in the day before house hacking was a term. And I kept it as a rental. I actually still own that property today.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, I bought a number of other properties and transition strategies and different things over time. But because of some of the reasons that I was deciding, you know, personal reasons, deciding to leave the military, a 9-to-5 and stuff was never really part of my plan. I did not write a resume. I never did a job interview. You know, it was just like, it wasn't even a plan B, right? I was like, I wanted to do something that I could control. You know, a lot of times we joke about entrepreneurs like leaving a 40-hour-a-week job to take an 80-hour and stuff like that. So I wasn't so concerned about the number of hours that I worked. I was willing to work hard, but I wanted control over when those hours were, you know, so that I could prioritize the time for my kids. So that's kind of some background on that decision.
Man, you know, you mentioned the conversation that you had with your daughter and what she said. I just think out of the mouth of babes comes so much truth. And we just talked about this on our last episode, Michael, that, you know, if we just sit and listen to our kids for a moment, you know, the truth that comes out that we've either masked in different, you know, excuses or given different reasons for, they're so quick to pick up on. So that's interesting. And then, you know, too, you hit on a point that I think is an interesting parallel. You talked about how, you know, either senior enlisted or senior officers, how they get comfortable in the military, looking for the next rank or hoping for the next rank because of that comfort that it provides. And that resonates so much with some of the other guests that we have on the episode, where they talk about the comfort that they build into their lives, whether it's the house that they've always wanted, the cars that they've acquired, the things that they're, you know, now buying, that lifestyle that they've got to maintain, how that creates this this feeling that they can't do anything else in their life because of all these other requirements. Yeah. And it's proof that it happens to us in the military. It happens to civilians all the time, where you just get complacent. You lull yourself into complacency, and you lull yourself into not realizing the dreams that you still have within you. And so, you know, I applaud you for recognizing that and for saying, hey, this is the time. I've got to get out of here before I get stuck.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate that, John. You know, I think that, not that the military is easy, but when you've done something for 10, 15, 20 plus years, we do get comfortable in that transition process, or like that, you know, we don't necessarily, you know, there might be certain components or certain jobs we want that you have to do an interview for or whatever, but we don't always have to write up these like resumes or do an interview, and we just kind of get comfortable in that, and the consistent paycheck every couple of weeks and things. And when I was in that role, when my daughter said that, I left the house before 6 o'clock every single morning, right? Like I was usually at work no later than 6 o'clock. And today I often am here at my desk at 5:30, 6 o'clock working. But on my calendar, from 6:45 to 7:45 every morning is blocked off for my kids.
Yeah.
Right. So if I was doing what I was doing then, I would be at work in a secure facility where I rarely ever talked to them during the day and didn't see the sun. And now I can come sit at my desk and work for a couple hours if I want in the morning, but I can take the hour off and wake my kids up, go through their morning routine, make them breakfast, get their lunch ready. I can be present.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So many people have said, you know, before us, you were talking about learning from those who came before us. And so many people who have gotten into the later years of their lives have often said, you know, one of my, either my biggest regret or one of the things I'd wish I had done differently is spent more time with my family and friends. So it's awesome to hear you made that conscious decision, Marcus, to be more present for you and your family.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And I'm glad my daughter said those words when she was 3 and not like 15. And just based on your comment there, I actually have this book here on my desk, Taking Stock. I don't know if you guys have read that one.
I haven't.
It's kind of the hospice doctors and stuff. So it just reminded me, you know, that's a lot of the message of people into their life and stuff, you know, talk about wishing they had made more time for family, friends, things like that. Then, you know, no one ever says, I wish I would have spent more time at work. So,
exactly.
So now you're making pancakes and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in your pajamas in the comfort of your own home, and you're running along Legacy Capital, as well as varying capacities for War Room, the Kinetic Man, which is the group that I met you in, and 7-figure multifamily masterminds. So share some of the exciting things going on across those ventures with our audience, and what they've enabled you to do in your personal life and your pursuit after the military.
Yeah. You know, so I mean, just like quickly on the Long Legacy Capital side, you know, as I got towards the end of my career, you know, my last tour was in England, and I knew I had made the decision to leave the military. And that's kind of when I transitioned into commercial real estate and multifamily. Like mostly I'd done single family type stuff before that. And I realized like, hey, if this is going to be, you know, kind of my path post-military and what I'm professionally going to be doing, you know, I need to be more systematic about the things that I'm doing, less opportunistic as I've been in real estate in years previously. And so that's kind of the strategy and the path that I decided to take. And it's been super rewarding over the past, we're about 18 months now, you know, since I, you know, my last day in the military. I don't want to say since I transitioned, that takes a long time and is still happening, but, you know, since my last day in the military, and it's been very rewarding. You know, John, you've met some of my partners, and to work alongside some teams in real estate that really do, you know, are doing more than putting a roof over a head, right? They really do focus on residents and providing a home, a place that they can call home, and building a community and things like that. So it's been very rewarding to work alongside partners that have those kind of values in the work that we're doing. And it's also been very rewarding to provide these investment opportunities to many of my peers, right? Like, so as I got into multifamily, I saw this opportunity where there's a lot of my peers that I'd worked with for, you know, in the past 10, 15, 20 years that were still active duty or still living overseas. And, you know, perhaps they wanted to invest in real estate or have exposure to it, but, you know, they're still busy or, you know, like I said, living overseas, and it's harder to do. So the ability to educate and provide that opportunity has been very rewarding and stuff as well. As far as like some of the stuff in the masterminds and things, you know, I was offered the opportunity to kind of coach both sometimes on a one-on-one individual basis as well as some small group settings in some of those. And I mentioned earlier on that, you know, I have a lot of educators in my family. And, you know, way back when, that was the initial degree that I had intended to go to school for. When I put in my commissioning application. And while I've never done education in a formal sense, you know, school system and things like that, I think I see a lot of that coming out now through some of my roles in some of these groups, and really enjoy the opportunity, both with some of my investors specifically, and then also in the ability to coach and stuff to spend time and help people along that way. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we're 18 months after my last day in the military, and there's still some new opportunities that are kind of opening up there. You know, I've some of those roles have given me an opportunity to speak on different levels, which I'm really enjoying, both, you know, about real estate stuff, but also as being a father, being a husband, some different aspects of life and stuff as well. And I've even, you know, had some conversations with my alma mater, the University of Missouri, and the business school there and stuff about some opportunities to teach, you know, college students and stuff.
Yeah, cool.
About real estate and things, which when I got my finance degree, real estate was, you know, not involved at all. And now there's more real estate stuff in school. So John and some others that I've been around for, you know, some number of years know that I have prioritized, you know, at times like trying to educate and give back. I still, you know, I give like some financial education books to the graduating seniors of my hometown high school every year. And so I think there's a, you know, towards the end of high school and into college, there's some years there that people can make some pivotal decisions that can change the trajectory of their life, right? And so the opportunity to potentially, you know, educate some college age students and share with them, you know, I'm not necessarily the, and my wife's kind of surprised sometimes. She's like, I don't really see you teaching a college, you know, classroom type of thing. But I think, you know, bringing in some of these like real world experiences and maybe a little bit less textbook stuff has been a unique thing. And admittedly, I'm balancing some of this. I'm kind of slow to say yes to some of these opportunities.
Yeah.
Because while they are things that I think I would really enjoy, I also have to look at the time commitment. And, you know, my kids right now are 9 and 6, and will those opportunities, or can I take those opportunities a few years from now instead of today, right? If it's going to take too much time away from the kids. And so I'm pretty slow to jump on some of them and take my time to try to balance it. Like, hey, you know, is this best for my family right now, even if it's something that I think I would enjoy, or should I wait 3 or 4, 6 years before I jump into that?
Yeah.
Strategically slow. I like it.
Yeah. And you know, I admit that with the military pension and some other stuff like that, I probably have a little bit more flexibility to not jump at some opportunities, you know, compared to someone that might be leaving or transitioning, without a, you know, some steady income coming in like that.
Well, man, I appreciate you providing your resources and your knowledge and the lessons learned, you know, in the arenas that I've been with you in. And as we wind down the episode, we, in keeping with the military theme, I want to ask you to provide kind of a turnover binder. So for those that don't know, when you hand over your job in the military to someone else that's coming in, you kind of create a list of things that they need to do on a daily basis to become successful. And that's what we like to do here, is ask every guest, hey, if somebody was to follow in your footsteps briefly, how would you concisely give them a tidbit of wisdom to help them out? So what's a piece of advice, a practical step from those that are contemplating just starting out in their second act or leaving the military and going into real estate or leaving their profession and going into something completely different? What would you leave for our audience today that would give them some hope, give them some advice from the things that you've seen work?
Yeah, thanks, John. You know, I think there's two quick things that I would say on that is, number one is to kind of to be true to yourself and the reasons that you decided to, you know, leave the first act, if you will, and why you're pursuing that second act. You know, I just kind of talked about, well, earlier, you know, I talked about pressure, you know, maybe from seniors, you know, maybe within in the military or maybe within your company, maybe from peers. Maybe you have opportunities that present themselves that you, you know, want to jump at, but they might be contradictory to the reasons. You know, I had a lot of opportunities in government and DOD contracting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That presented themselves based on some of the roles that I had played and my expertise in those areas. And while, you know, sometimes they might have seemed secure, they might have seemed like lucrative, you know, I knew based on the reasons I was leaving, I needed to get out of that field and out of that, you know, that environment for myself and for my family, right? And so I've just encouraged people to, that doesn't mean that, you know, sometimes if we're going to be an entrepreneur, we're going to do something, once in a while we have to do something for a little while that isn't our, you know, might not be our big dream, it might not be our lifelong thing. Sometimes we have to humble ourselves and do something different for a little while. But just remember, like, why you left that first act or what you were looking for. And if you have to do something temporarily, make sure you understand and think about where you're going. So that's probably the big thing. The second one is, I love what you guys are doing here and kind of, you know, asking people these questions and sharing people's experience. And so, you know, when you're doing that, I would just encourage people to reach out, you know, to others that have recently gone through, you know, these transitions. If you know the field that you're kind of going through, reach out to people that are in that field and stuff. And I've had people recently, I see this all the time in some of my coaching for multifamily and stuff too, is, John, you know very well that it's not a quick buck, right? It is a great way to build wealth over time. But it takes a lot of time to learn the business. It takes a lot of time to build the right relationships. And, you know, early on, a lot of our money is, our profits are going back to our investors. They're not coming necessarily to us as the active partners. And so it takes a lot of time to do that. And so sometimes people think like, hey, I'm going to peace out from my W-2 and go do this. I've heard you can build a lot of wealth. It's like, well, you might not want to just peace out too quick, right? And so I think it's good for you to have conversations with people and understand that the things to put into motion to prepare yourself to make that transition versus, you know, piecing out from whatever it was and then figuring out like, oh, I didn't have the reserves, I didn't have the income streams to jump into this field and stuff. So hopefully those a couple pieces of advice would be useful.
No, it's great.
Absolutely.
But this show can't go on forever. Unfortunately, I know, Marcus, you've got some things to get back to, and John and I do as well. But you have such an impressive background and are doing some really cool things in your second act. For listeners who are interested in following your story, as well as those who may want to get in touch, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Probably the one-stop shop is alonglegacy.com. If you go to the /connect, you know, there's a page there, has my calendar on it, social media, email, all that kind of stuff. So
okay,
if anyone just wants to follow along the journey, they want to kind of see what I'm doing, if anyone wants to reach out and ask those questions about, you know, the transition and things like that, feel free to schedule a call, shoot me an email. Happy to help.
Awesome.
I think of you, Marcus, as a man of faith, man of family, man that knows his finances. And so I would encourage anyone that has interest in the military, in real estate, to reach out to you, because you are such a joy, one, to talk to. You're so well-spoken and so full of information that it's a shame if people have questions and they don't reach out and kind of quench that thirst. So
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you personally, Marcus, for coming on the show, spending time with us. And Michael, I think I learned a ton from Marcus.
Oh,
again,
absolutely.
Every time I sit down and talk to him, I'm like taking notes and trying to make it a personal effort to reach back out to him. But I think everyone listening will find some incredible value with this episode today.
For sure. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Marcus.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Appreciate you having me again.
Thank you, Marcus. Appreciate it.
The Second Act with Michael and John stars Michael Newborn and John Ballinger. The podcast is produced by Seltzer Kings. For more information on the show, check out michaelandjohn.com. Or if you'd like to get involved in the conversation, give the guys a shout on their socials at The Second Act with Michael and John on most platforms. Thanks for listening.